Hi, I'm Sam Blake, and this is Behind the Bestseller. We're here to unlock the secrets of what makes a best-selling book. I'm a writer, a crime writer, and in this series, we meet a lot of writers to find out what makes them tick and how they work. I'm really interested in what actually goes into those books to make them hit the bestseller list. My guest today is a non-fiction author whose book, Mother Folklore, Dispatches from a Not-So-Dead Language, has taken the bookshops by storm. Behind the Bestseller is all about finding out what makes that book hit the charts. So, Derek O'Shea, what happened to you?
Well, I was very lucky that I wrote a book called Mother Folklore, Dispatches from a Not-So-Dead Language, and it did hit the bestseller list on its first week. And I think a huge part of that, in addition to the wonderful press push in Ireland and the UK from my publisher and their partners here, was the goodwill that had been generated for the book because of the social networking, the Twitter account it's associated with, which was the Irish Four.
Which is actually how I came across you in the first instance, wasn't it?
That is indeed, yeah.
Fantastic. For anybody who is out there and who wants to know anything about language or just has a curiosity for words, the Irish Four is an amazing Twitter account. Just tell us a little bit about that to start with.
Yeah, the Irish Four is a Twitter account I set up in early 2015. So it's coming on its fifth birthday. And it was something, there was a Twitter account called the German Four, which I really enjoyed. And I had been wondering if something like that could work with Irish. And it was around the same time I was getting more interested in Irish language. My dad, who's a fluent speaker, he wasn't as well as he had been, and I wanted to know, like most male Irish writers, I have a weird, quiet relationship with my father. I've always had, and I wanted to know kind of what made him tick, and I wanted to know why Irish mattered so much to him. He spoke many languages, but Irish was his favorite, and I always wanted to know why a guy with conversational Arabic and some Japanese and some as well as French and Latin,
goodness me,
loved Irish above all others. Mm. And so I started dipping my toe back in. This is around shortly after I got married, and we'd had an Irish, one of the readings we'd had was an Irish, and my dad also around this time also was unable to make a speech. He wasn't well enough, so I was kind of conscious that, you know, if I had big meaningful conversations to have with him, I only had a few months left, or yeah, maybe possibly years. I didn't know. As it happened, it was months. But
so those were important months.
They really were. Yeah. And then it came up to the fact I was dig into kind of some Irish language material that was available online or offline, and I just used it as a starting point in a conversation from him. And I just found that there was huge stories and beautiful meanings behind some of these words.
And that's really what's fascinating, isn't it? I suppose I'm an English person and I came across this. Although I've been living here for 25 years and I've been learning Irish to a certain extent through my children, learning Irish in school,
yeah,
I found that the revelation of the words that you chose and their meanings, and there are a lot of words that don't translate into English.
Yes.
Words that have the most amazing, incredible meanings in Irish that are just specific to the language. And that's what's just so exciting about it.
Yeah, it really is. And I just found that these are too good to keep to myself. And I just set up a Twitter account to start sharing them. I used the phrase the Irish Four because it was similar to the German Four, which was kind of my Twitter role model at the time. It quickly became bigger than that, which is interesting, and I don't think that account is even in use anymore. But
there's more Irish people out there than there are Germans, obviously.
Apparently so.
the famous diaspora.
Who knew? And this was the big thing. I found that just this moment in the roughly in the middle of the decade we've been having it, I find obviously social media was happening differently in Ireland than it was happening elsewhere. Probably it seemed to represent, I guess for so many previous generations in Ireland, when people left or had to emigrate, they were no longer part of the national conversation. Mm. And now suddenly they were. And all these things were happening, as we saw in the few years after that, things were happening in the national conversation that were in a way because immigrants weren't being excluded anymore.
Absolutely.
And a huge part of that, and I found people found that the Irish language connected to their homesickness, to the familiarity, whether it was sharing stories about mispronounced names.
Yeah.
And
I'm the worst because I always get your name wrong.
It's, you know, I think we appreciate effort, you know, if someone's having an honest stab. It's, I think, when people kind of maybe enjoy getting it wrong too much, that's when it's bad manners. Mm. So it seems that the Irish Four got some media attention fairly quickly, and quicker than I was expected. Within about 3 months, I think the Daily Edge had written a piece about it. Mm. And then shortly after that, Joe.ie wrote a piece about it. And then I found it was beginning to get
traction.
Yeah, getting a bit of traction. It was getting traction, things like BuzzFeed and things like that. And as time went on, and as the months went on, People said, you know, you're creating a lot of content for free that you don't technically own, that anyone else could just use, and you'd feel like a right idiot if someone else wrote a book with your stuff, with your research.
And, that is a very good point, actually.
And it was, and yeah. I did think, because I think I was aware that yes, you don't own the translation or word, and it did make me think that yes, that's, I actually do have permission to explain in my own words what a word means, instead of just giving the literal dictionary definition, which sometimes had. And I found that, say, sometimes you can make an observation in it, sometimes it can be topical.
Well, it was the humor, I think, in the thing that you brought to it, and that's something that was unique and is your unique voice. And although yes, other people could have taken that content and done something with it, what you did with it in the book, and you do with it on the feed, is bring that element of humour, and it's just a wonderful feed, because it honestly had me laughing out loud, and I think that is what you brought to the book in the end.
I think so. Thank you very much. It's great to hear that. And as it happened, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I had I'd done English and History of Art in university. I'd written a play in my first year in college, and that was a hard business to get to. I had a couple of manuscripts. You know, I'd gotten into, you know, over 100 pages, and I thought they were going somewhere, and they weren't, or they were. And
we've all been there.
Yeah, we've all been there. And you know, and I think it's important to actually get to that stage, to actually put that much work into something and still be able to say, yes, this isn't working, I need to abandon the whole thing, as opposed to just chipping away.
Very, very true, and a really good point. Actually, I think it's that finding your voice thing, and proving to yourself that you can do it, but also understanding what you're doing.
Exactly, and I think, and some people think that a novel is what they have to write if they want to be a writer, and there are other ways of going about it. There's
many other ways.
And it is, and since that's something we do get into it, because I was talking with other non-fiction writers, and that non-fiction writers never get asked about the writing process the way fiction writers do.
We're going to rectify that right now.
Certainly will, yes.
I think it's very interesting. There's two things you say there about feeding out through the Twitter feed was connecting people. I think the thing that social media does is create connections, and you were able to connect people. The famous diaspora. When you work in publishing, I get an awful lot of submissions and hear an awful lot of people talking about, oh, this book will be great for Irish people in America. And there's this sense that the diaspora are going to go running out and buy, because you're Irish, are going to go dashing out to buy your book. And in fact, that actually doesn't happen. But in your case, it did, because you did have this bond and you bought this thing out.
It did, and I think it got picked up in some of that. I think the idea, because it was related to the Irish language, and the way Ireland was being spoken about was just changing a little bit, and so it did actually, it got a little bit of attention in some of those diaspora minded international publications, but also some of the general ones as well.
It's very exciting. I think it's that connection, it's that sense of understanding the language, but as I say, it was the humour that you brought to it that really made it really different.
And that was a big thing. I think the fact that people, I wanted to say this needs to be good enough that a person with, you know, fluent Irish can say, yes, this is solid. This is a solid translation. This is acceptable. But also that a person, no Irish at all, can say, I can just enjoy this. The way there's a wonderful Instagram account called Every Single Word in Icelandic. And I don't speak any Icelandic, but I love that account.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Because the way it explains what the words means, I think I think echoes in Icelandic, it literally translates as mountain language.
Wow. And there's one, I don't know if it's Icelandic, there's one language that has like 42 words for snow. Perhaps that's Alaskan or something.
I think it's one of the Inuit languages. Yeah. I think the number keeps changing, because I think the initial people who came up with that theory, they weren't differentiating between the different dialects in parts.
So there's even more.
So it's probably either more or less, depending on which one you're picking. Yeah, but they definitely, lots of words for snow. The concept of weather is something also that is represented differently, because in a place where it's always snowing, the idea of weather as opposed to snow is a concept that isn't always incorporated in the language.
It's fascinating. I think as wordsmiths, and hopefully everybody listening to this is interested in bestselling and is interested in writing, obviously, but they're all wordsmiths, and it's that understanding of language. And that, I think that's what, which brings me to my next question, because that's what you bring to the picnic. That's what, it's that level that you can, that somebody who is a fluent speaker can read it and understand it, and somebody like me, who is about four words of Irish, can read it and really appreciate it. Yeah. But it's that expertise, and that is the key with non-fiction, isn't it? It is being an expert within your area, although you probably might not say that you're an expert at the time, you definitely are. But it's that, it's bringing that level of knowledge and understanding to the book that really makes a difference.
I think it was. And one of the big thing I found was as I started actually writing the book, beyond just the business of the actual seeing which tweets were worth including and how to include them in lists or in paragraphs or not, it did occur to me that the Irish language connected an awful lot of things that I was also very interested in between poetry and history and also politics and law and things like that. There was an Irish language aspect to how these things existed in Ireland and got to some of the key questions about things. And that all opened up while I was actually writing the book.
Which is fascinating. So it's not just a book about language. It digs much deeper than that. It digs really into the Irish psyche, doesn't it, I think?
I think so. I mean, I certainly tried to go that way. I found that by... I figured out that rather than just trying to write a dictionary, and there are some nice dictionaries out there that do a wonderful job, I wanted to actually incorporate my own journey with Irish into the actual, as the narrative that the book hangs around.
I was going to say, and it's a living language, isn't it? And that's what you bring to it, is that sense of the fact that it is living and that these words mean something for a reason.
Very much so. And you do get that, you see that straight away, that people do want to know what the Irish words for new things are. And when there's any kind of a movement happening, you find people do want an Irish language aspect to the slogan or the hashtag or whatever is going associated with it. That happens almost immediately.
That's fascinating. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there a little bit about structure.
Yes.
It's all very well for this, my phone going off again in the background. Throughout all of these podcasts, my phone goes off because I seem to be incapable of turning it off. But you talk there a little bit about structure. And that's really interesting because you say, oh, yes, a book about Irish language, and we've got the Twitter feed. And so it would be very easy for you just to have copied and pasted all those tweets and popped them into a book and bundled it up and sent it out. But in fact, you did a lot more than that. And the book, in fact, tells, as you mentioned, your story through Irish. Mm. But it also then has a structure of its own. So talk to me a little bit about the process that went into, I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of messing around and trying and failing and fiddling around. What brought you to that particular structure?
I was thinking, I suppose, it came to the fact that when people asked me why I was interested in Irish, and particularly in the early days when I wasn't able to present myself as any kind of as any kind of expert or anything like that, I wanted to talk about that people do engage with Irish. It comes down to names in their relationship with it's connected. It's one of the reasons Irish language turns up people's humour is they have shared memories from school, which crosses class in a very interesting way. And
regardless of their relationship as well, whether they hated Irish in school or not, it's still a bond, isn't it?
Yeah, and I found also the way, so in that sense, I found that these are shared experiences. People have different experiences of how their parents spoke it, particularly in Dublin. A lot of people in Dublin whose parents from the country have an experience of how their parents use it. They are conscious of the difference in how what the Irish means to their parents and what it means to them. And then I saw it's funny. Irish is a funny place in the class war in Ireland, in terms of some people think Irish is very is Ar of East or middle class or that Gaels goes this way, and other people don't think it's the exact opposite. When I went to school in Gonzaga, which is a Jesuit school on the south side, it was very much seen as having an Irish name meant your parents were either teachers or civil servants, and you know not from not company directors or anything like that.
Goodness me,
So and it was funny that that people have that the Irish language almost kind of reflects different things to different people. Mm-hmm. So get into the structure. I sat down and I was looking at, I had a big ball of words that I tweeted. I wanted to see which ones, what kind of categories they had. And I realized the categories I could fit them loosely around certain things about stories about love and politics. It occurred to me that was meaningful in the year I was writing to put those together, to associate ones we know from school and ones from secondary school and how those topics come in. The Irish college is another kind of unifying experience in Ireland as well, and how that changes a person's memories of Irish to the ones they have in primary school, because it's associated with I mean, we do have other kinds of summer camps, but that does seem to be a huge part of people's affection.
I think it's only like it's like a coming of age thing, isn't it? It really is, and it's seminal in everybody's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people do make a connection between the Irish language and their first kiss very often, which is fascinating to me. And maybe that's not something that has happened in maybe some other minority languages that have books talking about them.
That's very true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if a book about Icelandic would have that.
Would have that same. Angle, indeed.
So then I started off writing an introduction, just basically talking about myself and my dad, and then I started talking about my journey from primary school to secondary school to to college to work to becoming a father myself in the conclusion. And I found that all these different topics allowed me to focus on the vocabulary of work is being kind of one category in the vocabulary of secondary school. And those, particularly the really bad memories people have of Irish, do come into that late secondary school part. It's particularly the our conditional tense, the Mochanilic, and a very maligned woman called Peg Sayers.
Indeed. Yeah. So that's, and everybody who's ever studied Irish or knows anything about it will know precisely who she is.
That's right.
Indeed. But it's fascinating. It's fascinating that there's that emotional journey. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying there is, or it's only there, is that you actually had a narrative arc within the book. So yeah. Although the book is a bit like an a dictionary in some ways, there's actually a story that running through it. And I think that progress and that narrative arc is vitally important within nonfiction, that you feel that when you're reading it, that actually there's a story there too.
Yeah. And it was fairly critical as well, because I remember speaking to various people, people I was acquainted with in publishing, about the business of turning of evolving from a social media account to a book. First of all, that would create some expectations for a reader, but also at the same time, there had been some done already, and there was some social media related books had a kind of a. We're in the joke book category almost.
Yeah.
Like a book you might have next to the.
In the downstairs room.
In the downstairs room.
What you're looking for.
A downstairs room, a bathroom, or something like that. And I was aware that there was a perception that this book could have just listed out all the tweets on a cheap newspaper quite quality with a pint of Guinness with a shamrock out on the cover.
Lashed it out.
Called The Irish Four. And I was talking to a wonderful writer called Lisa McInerney, who I had met when I was volunteering at a book festival, and I'd definitely recommend any unpublished authors to give that a go.
Very good advice. Get into the business.
So we kind of knew each other online at the time. She was still writing for the journal, but she was bringing out her first book, which was a sensation, the Glorious Heresies.
Absolutely.
And I had asked her just about a little bit of for one or two pointers, and the thing that she said was, you know, that like the publishers will either be looking for a book or a writer, particularly with me dealing with agent stuff, an agent will want to find a writer rather than find a book.
Yeah.
And this is something that was I thought was really, really interesting.
Gold dust, absolutely brilliant advice.
And as I really thought so, because the big thing was you by the time writing one book wasn't something I really wanted to do. I wanted to be able to still have the credibility to approach with new books after the fact. And it would have been heartbreaking if I had been a one book wonder and learnt all this useful information about the publishing industry that I wasn't going to be able to use again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that as that two really just sort of highlight and reiterate two really useful pieces of advice there. Go to book events, do volunteer if you can, because yes, you're meeting authors, you're meeting publishers, you're meeting agents, you're making connections, you're understanding how the business works. And that thing that agents are looking for writers, they're not necessarily looking for that one book wonder.
Yeah.
An awful lot of people have blogs and they have Twitter feeds or whatever it is, that they're big on social media, but it's not just writing a book of the blog. It's not just about sticking the blog in a book. It is about being a writer. It's about creating the story.
And I think people do know that the if the material is available for free at somewhere else and you're selling it.
It's a tricky one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm without naming names. There's some that, but around the same time that I was getting published, I know that two other books that were kind of that had been used as social media profile, which were the Complete Ashton books, but also the Blind Boy book, both largely had built a following in advance.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah,
they built a following in advance from getting a huge amount of goodwill from their social media aspects, and in both cases for a couple of years before the book came out.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can do a publicity rush before a book, but really there's a difference between actually building fans, people saying, why haven't you written a book yet?
And embedding that thing, that concept in, isn't it? Yeah, no, certainly those are sensational, huge books that came out. But again, they'd found their crowd in the same way you had, found their audience. But then they produced books which again had this narrative arc, and it was about the writing as opposed to just sticking the blog into. I mean, and you say people know, but actually I don't think they do necessarily, because I'm always getting people emailing about, you know, I've got this great big blog and I want to write a book of the blog. But there is this concept that you can put, free content in and the people are then going to buy it, which doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, people do like to hold a book, but the thing you do want the people who've been following your online kind of activities, whether it's a you want them to actually be your kind of your primary audience, and also, you know, and with any good book, your readers or your sales team.
Yeah, absolutely. And but what you're doing is building on that, aren't you? Yeah. So you've got your social media platform, you've got your blog or your Twitter feed, but then what you're bringing to the book is the story, and you are bringing what you've got out there already to a new level, and really telling the story. And I think that is exactly what you did, and you absolutely nailed it, because it's really interesting to find out more about you behind. You do, from following the Twitter feed, you get a sense of you, because there is that humour there and some of the quirky, I'm going to ask you some examples in a minute for anybody who hasn't had a look at the book, but they're really quirky and they're really cool and really, really interesting. So you do get a sense of the personality coming through, but I think that bringing that to the book in a much bigger way, and certainly finding out about your father and his fascinating career and his multilingual ability, which is just incredible, really brought a different angle to it. And I think for anybody who is thinking of writing nonfiction and wants to build on any of these platforms, that's really what they have to look for, isn't it? They have to look to bring more to the picnic, to bring more story.
And you do find that. I think it's, and I suppose when you think about something, somebody else who, Paul Harrod with his Russell Carroll Kelly books, obviously there's the weekly column, which we all know, and it is very popular. Years on, he's managed to keep it fresh, and he's managed to find new angles to things. But in each book, there's a kind of a key storyline, which is completely different, which hasn't been shared before. Yeah. And he knows fine well that it would, you know, he's earned loyalty up from his readers, because they know they're getting more than what they see every week, and they still read every week, and they still go out and buy those books.
Absolutely. In their thousands.
Yes.
Thankfully, that's just fantastic. So just give us an example of, I'm going to put you on the spot now, I'm sure you'll be well able for it. Give us some examples of some of the words and some of the translations for people who haven't followed, who are now going to go straight to their phones, or perhaps they're on their phones already listening to the podcast, and they're going to pick up the feed.
Well, there's one which is interesting. I found some words where a single fada changes the meaning of a word completely.
I love those ones.
fan is like to stay, like fangavaka make or stay for a moment, and fawn, when you have a fada in there, is to leave. Completely opposite.
Complete opposite.
And fawn is also the root of the Irish word for a swallow. The bird is a fanlog, a little wanderer.
See, that's the connection. And and so swallows leave. And that to me is the joy of the joy of the feed and the joy of the language, is that the connections. It's like a composite language, isn't it? It's really building up.
Yeah, it really is. And it's and I think same way that, and sometimes people, you know, when someone's just called the Irish four, they wonder, is this etymology? Is it humour? Which is it? And, you know, why can't it be both?
Absolutely.
And say the Irish for a country is tear, which sounds like a teardrop. And, you know, and the whole business of countries and running them and to deciding who's in charge leads to many tears. But it's
And leaving too.
Mm. So I think that, and you, I say that, you know, if the big problem comes in when you try to pretend that the meaning is linked to the joke. Like there's a theory that the Irish for that Dracula comes from Dracula, which means evil blood.
Oh.
But it is not substantiated. And a part of me thinks, you know, we should still be allowed to have that wordplay.
Yes.
It doesn't have to. Once it's the sin isn't the wordplay. The sin is the pretending. It's a factual etymology. That Bram Stoker was an Irish speaker who used this and who hoped his mates would get it and never mentioned it in any of his letters because he was so committed to a joke. So yeah. I think, and sometimes you think that, you know, something like that is very witty and deserves to be shared.
Absolutely.
But in the context of it being, you know, it's being something that's interesting, necessary, as opposed to a historical fact. And sometimes there are wonderful facts too, though. There's a Eirik of Rook is from Old Irish, from the kind of medieval Irish, and it was the equivalent of phrase for a red herring. It means badger's horns.
They're so clever. I think some of them, they're just really, I think it gives you a real picture of the language and the way people were speaking and the way people were interrelating. And it's very pictorial, and it's just, it's amazing. It's a real eye opener, so it's well worth the following.
I think so. There's some really great visuals there for names for animals, names for creatures, names for ideas, and things like that. of that.
Excellent. And that's actually, a lot of that is in the book. Mm. And I think that's really, I think it's what's made the book interesting. It's what made it have a much, much broader appeal than people who are just Irish speakers. Mm. I think anybody who's interested in linguistics and words, it's really reached out to them. And that's really the fundamental of what makes a bestseller.
I think so.
It definitely is. And just in terms of what you are planning next, having written the one book and yes. battled for the structure and got your story in there, what's happening next?
The next one, I did a sequel to Motherfucker called Crack Baby. So instead of this time, I was focusing more on my relationship with my daughter. Mm. And the big hang on there was before she was born, we were thinking, yes, she's going to go to an Irish school. She's going to do this. She's going to do that. Shortly after she was born, she was diagnosed with Down syndrome. And I wanted to... And I realized, I suppose, all these expectations I had, and I want to put. I was still talking about language and how the ideas of language they contain so much of our expectations about what people are for. Mm. I was thinking about and it was still a struggle. This is all happening while I was in the business of the very early days of writing Motherfucker itself. Mm. The excitement of almost getting published, of meeting publishers, of nearly being there, probably helped push me through that time. And my wife didn't have that same kind of thing going on, yeah. So she was still we were grieving for the child we expected.
Yeah.
While trying to deal with this wonderful child we had, but dealing with it as couples always do in different ways, at different speeds.
Mm. It can be very difficult.
It really can, but she's 3.5 now. She's
going great.
She just had a Christmas concert this morning.
She's gorgeous.
Yeah, I'm just mad about her. But so I wanted to talk a little bit there about the ideas of how the assumptions in language, and also went in from there talking about things like Hiberno English and what Irish is going to be like when she's a child, an adult, a teenager. Yeah. Where Irish is going?
Very true, and how it's developing as a language.
So that was that, and that's so that was I think second books. I think the publishing cycle is very focused around first books, new authors, big things. So selling a second book is harder than the first. Promoting it is harder than the first. And
really is, actually, because of the whole of that whole sort of excitement and the newness of a book when it's the second book has already been done with the first one, isn't it? So it's all uphill.
It is. And that is something that I think that a lot of other people have to have experienced, and it is a thing else. And so in that sense, And there is a thing that, say, my publishers had organized a very, very strong kind of a media campaign for opening in terms of the interviews and articles I was going to be doing. And what often happens is in both the radio and the newspaper business is sometimes articles with interviews with authors are, on one hand, they're great because they're perennial quality. Mm. You can put them down any time. As opposed to you'll have a certain amount of news stories that are only matter today.
They're time sensitive, indeed.
And what radio producers love is, say, that the minister has just cancelled and they need a 7-minute interview to fill that slot. It goes great, and they do love that, but it also means you're more likely to be bumped.
That's very true.
and this is also true in the newspaper business when you might have an interview, and they can say, well, the interview can come out 2 weeks after the book, no big deal, no big deal to them.
Makes a big difference to you as an author.
Makes a difference to you, and then so if they suddenly sell a full-page ad, you might be waiting an extra week or so. Yeah. So it's best laid plans. You can find that suddenly you've done a lot of interviews, you've written certainly some columns, you've you've spoken to people, and then you might find there's actually suddenly no coverage at all, which can happen in a week. But then at the same time, having said that, so Crackbeard didn't have the big opening, but it has sold very strongly. It's the Head of Zeus did a very similar cover, so people recognize immediately that it's associated with Motherfucklore, and it's kept trying.
And I think the thing about non-fiction is that it's what's called long-tailed, what I call long-tailed, which means that it will keep trickling along and it'll keep chugging along and it'll keep on going. Whereas with commercial fiction, really, a book can have quite a short shelf life, and it might only be a couple of months. And then, it might still be in the shops, but it's unless you're writing perhaps a series to keep that book out there, then it can be quite short-tailed. So hopefully that long-tailedness and the fact that they're not time-sensitive books, they're not going to age, that they're just going to keep on selling and chugging along nicely for you. That's what we hope.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting that we're talking about the marketing there, because I think the marketing angle, particularly particularly with books, it's vital. It's vital that people know that the book is there on the shelf. Mm-hmm. There's this whole concept of in the real world, people need to see things three times before they buy.
Yeah.
And online, it's 10 or more. So you need to be out there and you need to be everywhere, really, for your book to hit, don't you?
Yeah.
And you're so right. If there happens to be an ash cloud or, political assassination or anything that can happen, mm-hmm. In the news, and then it's very easy to get bumped. So
very much so, and I suppose there's been a lot of I know this year I don't have a new book out this year, hopefully soon, but there were a couple of stories that did just dominate the particularly celebrity deaths. I'm thinking of Clive James and Greg Gayburn this year, because they crossed news and culture in their spheres. They took a lot of calm space and now, having two books down, I'm always thinking, oh, whose review got bumped there?
I know. The irony of it gets, because you can put a lot of effort, you can put a lot of money and a lot of time into marketing, but yeah, you are slightly at the peril of the of what's going on in the world. But it is very interesting what you say there about, and I think you probably have an advantage, certainly with nonfiction, and certainly this type of book, because when you are writing different articles for different magazines and newspapers, and you're expected to do that as part of the sort of marketing process, you've got lots of different angles, so you can make it really quite interesting for the various audiences. And did you find that was something you were able to do?
That is the thing, particularly the second book. I found that there was more publications, they wanted me to write something for them instead of me being interviewed. Yeah. And, you know, and before and often I think sometimes you think, yes, I want to be interviewed. I want them to talk about, you know, like Dark O'Shea is wearing a cool leather jacket and looks very relaxed today. He nods sadly as I mentioned this to him, you know, but you
want to be the star.
Exactly. You want to be the star. And the big thing is, you say, well, how much of my book do I give here? And do I write something that's a little bit different on one particular topic or not? And what will they jump on? What will they bite? And so I did. I wrote a couple of things for that, and generally they were quite well received. And those articles, particularly, they can be widely shared, which is nice.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah, and I think that's a massive advantage. Certainly, when you're writing fiction, there's only so many things you can say about a book, and I always find it quite difficult to come up with different angles for different people.
Yeah,
because we as fiction authors, we have to do that too. So I think that's something for people to be prepared for. That when whatever your book is, whether it's fiction, whether it's non-fiction, is to be prepared for that. Yeah, you are going to have to talk about it. You're going to have to find the hooks and the angles. We always talk about, when we're talking about selling books, coming up with that killer pitch.
Yeah.
I mean, The Irish Four absolutely has the best killer pitch ever, Mother Fuckler. And I'm going to ask you about the title now. We mustn't forget about that. But it really does have a pitch. And so it's an easy hook and people understand exactly what it's about. And so for anybody listening, start thinking about that now, really. So talk to me about the title.
Okay. So the title was something that the pun was, I was aware I'd come up with a while back. I hadn't found a way to incorporate in a tweet or anything like that. When initially I didn't want to call the book The Irish Four. I think it's one thing calling an account that, and calling a book that, there's a different expectation in terms of its authority to say, you know, if you call a book, this is, you know, The Irish Four.
People. Yeah. Especially with Irish, when there can be many different words in different areas for the same thing. Yeah.
And it's funny, even so, then there's a difference between how even the authority a sentence carries in speech or in word. Like, I remember that I was listening to a documentary recently about Max Martin, the Swedish songwriter, and he had worked out that with the song Baby One More Time, he said, you know, the lyric is Hit Me Baby One More Time, but if you write Hit Me Down, it looks much worse than if you just sing it.
Yes.
And yes, because then if you know, nobody wants to buy a song called Hit Me.
No.
Well, I hope not anyway.
No, exactly.
And he only found it after he'd written it, and actually that's he thought it was slang for Call Me, and it wasn't.
And it wasn't, yeah. So these are the things that you don't realise at the time as a writer.
And at that point I thought, the context of calling it the Irish Four was not, and I at this point I'd gotten in touch with Sally Ann Sweeney, who is a wonderful Irish agent in London.
Indeed, who we have interviewed for this podcast too.
She's a vault of common sense and nerve as well, which is great. And I talked to her. She was saying what kind of and she was, when we were in our initial conversation, she wanted to, you know, see did I just want to make a quick book of a quick book, or did I want to actually be a writer? And I very much wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to capture the irreverence, but also the and put the context of the, I wanted to put the Irish language in a little bit of a pop culture context as well. And I thought that this is the appropriate amount of cheekiness was calling it mother folklore, and folklore being the Irish word for a dictionary.
And so, you'd have to know that.
And then she says that that's really, really clever. Really liked it. She liked it straight away. When she had my initial extract of a manuscript that was presented to a number of publishers. A lot of them initially wanted to meet me, and a few of them didn't like it. A few of the Irish-based ones, interestingly enough, thought, not sure about this. You any flexibility in the title at all? And as it happened, Head of Zeus, Neil Belton, the publisher in Head of Zeus, the legendary publisher. It's a phenomenal career. And like many people... like many of the amazing people I've met since I've written books, incredibly modest.
Yes.
And like it seems to be this recurring theme that the people who I admire most in the business are almost
the quietest.
Yeah. Yeah. So self facing. But he said, yes, let's run with this motherfucker. Love it.
Yeah.
That's great. And then what really blew me away was he was like, this guy writes really well. He was in his notes. And you say there's a Twitter account as well.
That's very Neil, isn't it?
And I just thought it meant so much to me that like, I thought I had almost given up on ever getting published. And I thought this Twitter account happened. But he is almost like the Twitter account wasn't almost a deciding factor for him.
No, the book, it was the book that he bought because he had no concept of the background.
So, and that made me think that these guys were the right match for me, and I was absolutely delighted. And then he said, was it just motherfucker? And like, as it happens in cinema now, most titles have a little have a colon and a little tag. Yeah. And then we were saying, well, are we going to say, I was going to say Dispatches from the Irish Four. And he was like, you know, we don't have to play up the account connection if you want to, you know, we can. And you know yourself, and at this point, we thought, well, is Twitter even going to be a thing in 4 years' time?
Well, exactly. And you really want to reach out to new people as well as your... Yeah. Twitter people.
Mm-hmm. And he thought, yeah, it was better not to. And then we got some notes back from the editors in Head of Zeus, who are based in London and Clerkenwell. And they were saying that, you know, well, we're going to go with Dispatches from a so-called dead language, Dispatches from not quite dead language. And then we went through a couple of these, and I thought, well, I thought not so was the appropriate pitch to get this exactly right. Because I wasn't initially delighted with the word dead language there, but Neil thought a little bit of provocation was useful for a bit of controversy.
Absolutely. Well, I like it because it's the little bit of humour in there too, because it is a not so dead language, because actually there's loads of people that speak it who are out there, but they're all speaking it privately and quietly that's what I interpret it. And so everybody's speaking it quietly and between themselves in a very sort of covert, nearly way. But it's wonderful because it's keeping it alive and keeping it warm. And
it really is.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. It's really, and title is so important. But do you know something that you've really hit the nail on the head there, and again, this is something for people out there who are listening, having somebody who's passionate about your book. So having Sally Ann approach you, and the hilarious thing is that I actually approached you as well at that point. And I worked very closely with Sally Ann, so I had her completely in mind for this book. And I remember we were ping-ponging backwards and forwards, and then you said, you were talking to Sally Ann, and I'm like, yeah, well, that's exactly where I was heading. she was off the mark quicker than me. And having somebody who's passionate, who's spotted you, who's passionate about your book, and then having Neil, who completely got it before, without even knowing about the Twitter thing, that is so important, because that really, it's what pushes a book through, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And that's the thing. And I, on my own podcast, I was speaking to Lisa Cohen recently about she's one half of Tramp Press,
one of
the greatest sensations in the Irish book world of this decade. And again, she was talking about there's this whole, sometimes books are kind of described as word of mouth hits, and you know, these authors just being these things, and there's a huge team. And the reason we want to meet incredible people, because book people are the best people. Yeah. And the idea that, say, yes, you can self-publish a book on the internet or on one of those apps. Yeah. But then you really want to know what the inside of a published house looks like. You want to walk in. You want to meet people who have these things. You want to get little notes written back saying, "I love this part," or "change this."
That's the joy of working with an editor, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful, and it was wonderful to see actually that. And even I know from my weekly column and as well as from the books, you think, God, you know, sometimes they say, you get a note back and you say that, why, I can't believe they didn't get this, or I can't believe they changed my wonderful line. But then you think, well, what about the four or five other things, and they absolutely saved my bacon?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so absolutely there's not enough love for sub-editors and editors and all the other people in the different parts of the publishing process.
It really is a huge process, and there's a lot of people involved, definitely. Mm. That's fantastic. So just give us a plug here now for your podcast and your column, and tell us where people can find you, and repeat the name of the book properly.
Okay, so the two books so far, Mother Folklore, Dispatches from Not So Dead Language, and the sequel is Crack Baby, Dispatches from a Rising Language.
Excellent.
So the podcast is also called Mother Folklore. It comes out from Headstuff itself, and comes out every Friday in the Headstuff Podcast Network.
So it'd be very easy to find for people.
Absolutely, spelled the same way. And we've had a huge, huge growing following for that. So that's been absolutely wonderful. And I write a column for thejournal.ie every Sunday.
So that keeps people, there's loads of things there. People can listen, they can read, they can buy the book, which is the most important thing ever.
Yes.
And they can find out, hopefully they'll listen to this and they'll find out what goes into making that best-selling book. Just tell me very, very briefly, how long did it take you to write?
I had a lot of the tweets and research done in the kind of years beforehand. I had a final manuscript. From signing with Head of Zeus to the from signing with Sally Ann to getting the final manuscript in, I'd say that was 6 months.
Yeah, so it's a good time, amount of time. Bearing in mind that you'd spent years building the podcast.
And I was
not podcast,
yeah, but the Twitter account, yeah. So the Twitter account had been going for a year and a half at that point.
Yeah.
And also, so I was writing this, but I also had a new baby at this time.
Indeed. This is important to bear in mind that obviously, but lots of writers out there, we all have things going on, and it just shows you that, and also you have a day job.
Yes.
We have to mention too. So, so as well as the day job and the new baby, you managed to produce a book. But what's very interesting is that despite all of those years and the background in linguistics and the fact that you'd done the degree and all of those things, you still took time to really put effort into the book, and it took 6 months is a fair chunk of time. So for anybody out there who thinks that they've got a blog and they can write a book in 3 weeks, it's just not a thing.
No, not a chance.
That time is really important, isn't it?
No, the time is really important. And, you know, if you're in a relationship, you will need the support and acceptance and belief of your partner, whoever the person you're with, because like there isn't enough. There's a reason people dedicate books to their partners, because you know it's a hell of a thing in terms of just there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of event, parties they'll have to go to on their own because you won't be going with them.
Yeah.
You'll be calling a lot of favors. I got my wife an eternity ring after the first book.
So, oh, that's lovely.
Because you know, she deserves it. Mm. And so it's unfortunately it creates an expectation every book. I mean, a new ring now.
Not a bad thing. I have a jewellery thing going on with books too. I buy myself a piece every time.
Oh, you're dead right. So it's when the third book does come out, or if I'm lucky enough to get published a third time, because I take nothing for granted. I'm grateful for everything that's happened so far. Everything else in publishing for now is just bonus. So if the book I'm working on now does get published in the end, yes. So another present for my wife, who's puts up with an awful lot of things that when I'm writing, I could be tidying up, or I could be cooking, I could be doing
a million other things.
Yeah, so that definitely needs some recognition.
Excellent. So that's, I think that's a lovely place to finish. So dedication, very important. Put in the time, put in the effort, be the expert, and just work really, really hard at it. But also discover your passion and use that passion to communicate to other people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But find the thing you're obsessed with. The thing you can't shut up about might be a thing you're good at writing about.
Excellent. That's it. Nailed it on the head there. Thank you so much, Derek O'Shea, for joining me behind the bestseller.
Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you out there for joining me for Behind the Bestseller. I'm Sam Blake, and we're here to unlock the secrets of best-selling books. Join me again soon to hear from more writers to find out what inspires them, what makes them tick, and how they work and how they achieve success. Find more about me at Sam Blake Books on social and at samblakebooks.com. Find out more about writing at writing.ie. And if you need one-to-one help, check out inkwellwriters.ie. Thank you. Thank you.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.